Thank you, Will. Kevin has requested that a reading be read prior, and it's on his laptop, so we'll be all techie, and I'll read it. Okay. In 2005, several congregants at one of the largest UU churches in the U.S. were asked why they regularly attended services on Sunday mornings. A relatively... wants to join the internet. We don't need the internet. Kevin?
Sorry. The
council isn't working. Okay, sorry about that. A relatively new member said the following: I think what I needed most was to feel like the whole world isn't about all the guys who want to take advantage of you and make money, all about business or Halliburton or torturing. I wanted to feel like there was another truth, another side to life, that there was a group of people who cared, people in my community who cared about the world being better. It's not just survival of the fittest or the ones with the most money or the most power. That, and also just having a quiet moment in my life. Church is extremely good for helping me find such moments. A more long-time participant at the church said this about Sunday services: here you can just expect what's going to happen and when. It lends itself to what I would call liturgy. Our church stays more spiritual for me than previous Unitarian churches I've attended. At those other churches, they would let people get up to share joys and concerns and make announcements. But they can't do that in this church because it's too big. I thought I wasn't going to like that, but what I found is it keeps the service on a more spiritual level for me. To not have people getting up with happy joys and sad sorrows. At this church, the spirituality just sort of stays up there. So I've come around. Kevin LaPointe has been a UU since 1995, when he first joined this Fullerton UU church. He has continued to participate in other congregations where he has lived, first in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and currently in Denver, Colorado. Kevin earned a PhD in sociology at the University of New Mexico in 2010. For his dissertation, he conducted a qualitative study at three large liberal churches to discover the reasons why members joined and stayed over time. His study, entitled Liberal Devotion, The Sources of Strength and Solidarity in Inclusive Religious Communities, is currently being re-edited for publication as a book. Now, as Will mentioned, I'm up here to introduce Kevin. Thank you for indulging me. Because Kevin and I have been friends since third grade. And our friendship has just spanned the test of time. And most of all, in high school, we would eat lunch with our little group of friends right down here at Fullerton High School. And we shared a common trait in that we both were very curious about religion and the big questions, but we hadn't been raised in a religious home and we didn't have religious parents. So we were sort of clueless. It's mutually clueless about the big questions, and we've spent a lot of time talking about them. So at lunch, we would often bring up a topic, and all the group would be involved in the conversation, some of those people in this room right now, and then other people would get bored with it and drop off, and by the end of the lunch period, Kevin and I would be the sole discussers, and we would be probably screaming at each other, neither of us willing to concede the point, and only the bell to go eat lunch, or to finish lunch and go to class, would stop our argument. But we never held a grudge, and we kept asking the big questions and learning about different religions and trying out different churches, and obviously we're here to tell the tale. But sometimes, I don't know if anyone's had this experience, sometimes it feels as if everything comes around full circle. And I had this experience yesterday when I came to church to lock up after Casey McDaniel had spent the entire day working on his Eagle Scout project, which is to renovate our preschool and childcare rooms. And I had this vivid memory of myself sitting in an Eagle Scout ceremony about 30 years ago, just in awe. I didn't really know what that badge was. But I sat there in awe listening to this Boy Scout leader talk about everything that was involved. And I was so proud of my friend and his accomplishment. And I sat there and I remember thinking, I hope I'm friends with this kid for the rest of my life. And so 30 years later, here we are. That Eagle Scout was Kevin. And I'm so proud to introduce him to all of you and share our wonderful friendship with you.
Well, good morning. I'm so happy that Laurel invited me back to this church. I have not been here in many years since I sort of started traveling outside of California, living outside of California. It's wonderful to be back. It brings back a lot of good, fond memories. This is a sermon that I actually gave at my church, my former church, when I was living in Albuquerque, New Mexico, talking a little bit about my dissertation findings. I hope you find it interesting. They certainly had a lot of questions, and I will take questions after I'm done. It was a little over 4 years ago that my former minister at the UU Church I attended in Albuquerque stood at her pulpit and said the following. She said, "In this church, we can define God in our own ways and find people here who will delight in our creativity, not scold us for our heresy. We are glad that we can share our intuitions that this life which we are given is what is important, that no one will scold us for not believing in a life hereafter, even if that's what they themselves believe. It's such a relief for so many of us not to have to recite a creed with our fingers crossed. This is a place where we can come as we are, religiously speaking, believing what we believe, and it's okay to join a community and keep one's freedom. That's such a liberation for so many people that one very common response of our new people and many of our not-so-new people is tears. Finally, somewhere they can be themselves." As a member of that UU church for about 8 years while I completed my PhD in sociology at the University of New Mexico, I was regularly inspired by that minister's sermons. But the one that particular morning especially resonated with me. Like the majority of all Unitarian Universalists, I joined this denomination after leaving a more conservative church, E.B. Free Fullerton, in fact, where I had come to feel increasingly uncomfortable and unwelcome, because it did not reflect or celebrate my most cherished values. I still remember how wonderful it felt, now, almost 20 years later, to discover my first UU church, this one here in Fullerton. In this place, I didn't have to agree with a creedal statement of theological beliefs in order to belong. There weren't any traditionally religious moral codes that could condemn me or strict membership requirements that might prevent me from joining. It was this inclusive environment with its simple membership requirements that led me to first begin exploring alternative spiritual messages about the sacred importance of difference and diversity in our world. Being welcomed and accepted unconditionally sent a powerful message. I was able to join a faith community and keep my freedom, as the Albuquerque minister I quoted earlier said in her sermon. Finally, this was somewhere I could just be myself. In some ways, encountering Unitarian Universalism for the first time was life-changing, and if asked, I know that meant several of you would be able to recall a similar experience, either here or at a previous UU church, when you, too, were, if you'll excuse the phrase, born again to religious liberalism. As one longtime churchgoer at the UU Church in Albuquerque told me, discovering Unitarian Universalism was like finally discovering a home. She had a home, and so many of us feel that way too. My presentation this morning deals with what I call inclusive styles of faith like ours, and it's based on my sociological dissertation, completed in 2009, that examined the strengths and weaknesses of liberal religions that are defined by their limited membership requirements. I want to thank Laurel for inviting me to speak today. As she mentioned, she has been and remains one of my longest time friends. We met actually in third grade down at Acacia, just down the street, so it's kind of nice to drive by there today. It's a wonderful gift to be able to maintain a friendship with someone like her for so long. I'll touch on some of the highlights from my dissertation this morning, and I hope you find it interesting and that you'll discover something in this material to deepen your appreciation of what it means to be a religious liberal in general and a member of a Unitarian Universalist church in particular. Let me begin by explaining that my study was conducted at three Albuquerque-based churches that similarly identified and promoted themselves as welcoming, liberal, or progressive, where they each declared just about anyone is welcome. These included a radically inclusive Episcopal parish with a very traditional Christian liturgy on Sunday mornings, a United Church of Christ congregation, not to be confused with the Church of Christ. The United Church of Christ were actually the Congregationalists, which are sort of in our own heritage tradition. And they reflected the core characteristics of what we often associate with mainline Protestant churches in America. And the third was the thriving UU church that I attended, and which has been recognized as one of the denomination's breakthrough congregations. It is the 11th largest in the nation with just over 800 members. So I gathered data by observing and participating in a wide range of activities in all three of these faith communities for over a three-year period, and by extensively interviewing their members, their voluntary lay leaders, and many new members. The three groups were all officially welcoming churches, signifying the importance they placed on inclusive values, and reflected through their support of women in ministerial roles and formal outreach ongoing to gay and lesbian participants. All of the religious liberals I met in these communities similarly criticized Christian and other forms of religious fundamentalism, and they prioritized individual freedom and member diversity over group conformity or submission to conventional religious authority. So why was I interested in studying inclusive groups like these? It's because, as a religious liberal myself, I'm concerned about the future of religious liberalism in America. Although those of us in this room value diversity and individual freedom in our approaches to faith, the reality is that most liberal and mainline Protestant denominations across the country that are characterized by their variously relaxed membership standards regarding doctrines and traditional morality are struggling to survive. These religious institutions have experienced a sharp decline in participants and social influence over the past six decades, and the downward trend is continuing, though at a somewhat slower rate in recent years. Surprisingly, our own denomination halted its severe member decline around 1982 and has actually grown slightly overall since then. We're one of the few liberal religious groups to do so. And yet a third of all UU churches nationwide continue to shrink each year, and most do not grow at all. In fact, the growth that is occurring in our denomination is being driven by only about 20 large, successful congregations, including the one I attended and observed in Albuquerque. So the situation is frustrating, especially since public opinion surveys indicate that among the ever-growing number of Americans who are now claiming no church or religious identity whatsoever, especially younger people, most share the sort of liberal values and inclusive social attitudes that welcoming congregations like ours celebrate. So why aren't more of them attending churches like this one? And why do so many of those who do visit inclusive faith communities and agree with the liberal principles promoted in those settings apparently lose interest over time and eventually stop attending? Most sociologists who study religion have concluded that liberal churches are inherently and inevitably weak institutions because they ask so little from participants. Churchgoers who don't fear hell and feel no social or divine pressure to stay involved in their religious communities over time find it quite easy to drop out, and so they often do. Undoubtedly, this even includes some who were initially enthusiastic about finding a so-called home where they could just be themselves. One UU member I interviewed at the Albuquerque Church summed up this apparently widespread tendency among many religious liberals by saying, "I heard that you go from Lutheran to Methodist to Unitarian to the golf course." I'm sure that even some of you are occasionally tempted to spend your Sunday morning somewhere other than here. So why is it then that some liberal-minded people choose to stay involved in organized religion week after week, year after year? What keeps such devoted churchgoers inspired over time, drawing them back regularly for Sunday services and other church activities during the week? And perhaps most importantly, why do some inclusive faith communities, including both the UU Church and the Episcopal Parish I observed in Albuquerque, continue to grow and thrive, defying the patterns of decline that most other liberal churches face? Let me share three things I discovered during the course of my research. First of all, I found that people who attend liberal churches do so for the same basic reason that conservative believers are active in their faith communities. I'll say that again because it might sound shocking. I found that people who attend liberal churches do so for the same basic reason that conservative believers are active in their faith communities. What do we have in common with conservative churchgoers? Well, from a sociological perspective, all types of churchgoers have a similar desire to celebrate, be inspired by, and yes, worship their core ideals with others. We come to church and stay involved over time because we encounter something special and rare and precious here that we don't find or experience elsewhere in our lives. What devoted churchgoers feel regularly in their faith communities gives them the strength to return to their everyday lives and with greater hope and confidence. In effective faith communities, people not only feel connected to others who share their deepest values, but are encouraged to feel that their own life and all of life is somehow mysteriously valuable. It is what we feel in our relationships at church that is most important to the success or failure of a congregation. Many sociologists refer to such emotionally evocative, life-affirming moments as sacred experiences because they are so distinct from our everyday activities and because they seem to validate our very existence. We are stronger people when we participate regularly in a community of shared sacred experiences. Ultimately, these cherished encounters are what make a congregation special and unique for us, and without them, we wouldn't continue attending. Now, many of those I interviewed at the three churches described how their relationships with specific individual people in their congregations were what they most enjoyed. For them, these social and interpersonal interactions were what they experienced as sacred. Some attended with their spouses or their partners or with their children, and Sunday services were thought of as providing quality time for their families each week. Others, especially retirees or those who were recent transplants from other parts of the country, and there were a lot in Albuquerque, they enjoyed the opportunity to meet new friends in their community who shared their values, their interests, their hobbies, or who wanted to work together on community service projects or social activism with others. These social connections created bonds for many people, making their church involvement a worthwhile experience. Unfortunately, social researchers have consistently found that churches characterized exclusively by such close-knit relationships often have trouble growing. Not only can cliques develop that can make visitors feel unwelcome, but people who attend church only because they enjoy a few close relationships there have a tendency to drop out when those relationships are disrupted or end. So people leave when their spouse or partner dies, or there's a divorce, or children grow up and stop attending, or friends in the congregation move away, or conflicts arise between them and others in the church. Even though social ties are sacred experiences for many people, therefore, liberal churches that rely on these alone have almost always been shown to be weak, unstable institutions, and they do not grow, they shrink. For churches to be strong, sacred experiences must consist of more than just social encounters. So my second research finding was that the thriving, inclusive churches in my study were each described by their participants as being more than just social clubs or political organizations. Instead, people I met emphasized the importance of spirituality in their congregations. And what they said was the ability to worship with others. You heard this sentiment in the two quotes that Laurel read just before my sermon from new members I interviewed at the UU Church specifically. Such comments were significant because religious liberals in the U.S. often have a tough time creating sacred collective or group experiences. This is perhaps because Christianity has served as the sole basis for what most Americans think of as religion. All of the liberal and mainline denominations are rooted in Christianity, a style of faith that was historically expressed through orthodox creeds and exclusive moral codes that defined people as being good or bad, saved or damned, in or out, just like Evie Free taught me so well. And so for religious liberals who cherish inclusivity, diversity, and critical thought, rejecting that form of Christianity often results in a growing rejection of religion entirely. They don't think there is an alternative. This was the case almost two centuries ago when liberal-minded churchgoers in the U.S. first began promoting more inclusive ideals in their congregations by minimizing Christian traditions they found divisive, offensive, or simply irrelevant in the modern world. In time, though, so much had been eliminated from Sunday services and church culture in general that some groups began losing the ability to create experiences of worship around anything at all. Nowhere was this process more extensive than among Unitarians and Universalists. By the time these two groups merged in 1961 to become our present denomination, many local congregations had eliminated so many Christian elements of worship without replacing them with alternatives that they lacked almost any sign of collective spirituality. No times of silence or contemplation for the group, no rituals, no candles or symbols, no music. Nothing to help people transcend their individual lives and their differences and become connected around a collective worship of the inclusive ideals they affirmed. Even today, so-called UU fellowships continue to operate in this manner, and they are all declining in numbers. Most people at the UUA head office believe that they will probably be gone in about 20 years. I observed this very process slowly taking place during my study at the United Church of Christ congregation that I studied. Although religious liberals there continued to nominally identify as Christians, few reported finding any real meaning or emotional power in their worship routines on Sunday mornings. Their minister also supported the gradual elimination of practices that seemed to conflict with her group's inclusive values. With few and declining tools to evoke any feelings of worship among the group, those who attended that church, that UCC church, did so only because of the individual friendships they enjoyed there. It was therefore not surprising when I discovered that the majority of UCC congregants complained about a distinctive lack of spirituality in their group experience. One woman I met ultimately decided to leave the church in search of greater spiritual fulfillment elsewhere. What you may be interested to learn, as I was that her search led her to the UU Church in Albuquerque. Yes, that spiritual seeker found the Unitarian Universalist Church to be more spiritual than a Protestant congregation. Which leads to a third and final finding from my study that I'll discuss this morning. The UU Church is an Episcopal parish, I observed, both growing and thriving by reaching out to a wide range of inclusive-minded spiritual seekers and providing them opportunities to encounter sacred experiences through rituals that celebrated the ideal of diversity itself. Such successful inclusive churches do not avoid religious practices or rituals, but promote what some people I interviewed in the UU congregation there described as liturgy, as you heard earlier. Creatively drawing from multiple faith traditions, including Christianity, paganism, and Zen Buddhism especially, they engaged in routines that people could rely upon each week for inspiration and feelings of being in solidarity, again, despite their differences as individuals. They worshipped and took spirituality seriously, and not only on Sundays. The UU Church also promoted a variety of distinctly spiritual, contemplative, meditative practices and activities during the week, from Buddhist and other types of meditation to nature-oriented pagan ceremonies and many so-called covenant groups, where the discipline of silent and non-judgmental deep listening to others was practiced. That UU Church, and the minister in particular, consistently encouraged members to explore religious traditions and reclaim spiritual practices they found useful as their own, to explore words and symbols and rituals that worked for them, that inspired them, and that could be used to celebrate their inclusive ideals. In a sermon, the minister once said, "It doesn't matter which reverent words you use after all, or exactly what they mean to you. What matters is that you use some." That church's success was due to the fact that it was a spiritually oriented community, where even self-described atheists told me they had come to value sacred routines and come to identify themselves as spiritual atheists. The church encouraged religious liberals with diverse backgrounds and beliefs to worship a distinctive vision together, to experience together a sense that inclusive ideals are of utmost importance, not only because we individually support them, or because they're promoted by this church or this denomination, or because they are rational and make sense for humanity, but because they are somehow felt to be reflected and affirmed within all of life. That diversity reflects a spiritual reality and a spiritual value that our denomination is uniquely poised to celebrate. That the variety within that UU church, and that exists throughout society, and that was expressed each week through the multiple religious symbols displayed in that congregation's sanctuary, that those reflected together a universal fundamental truth about reality, that in life's diversity we can sense and celebrate some mysterious unity. It's a sacred mystery, many told me, that those in that UU church not only could call by many names, a phrase those UUs repeated together each week before their time of silent meditation, but which they felt could only be called by many names, that there was no single name that could be used. It was a way of experiencing ultimate reality that many spiritual seekers at both the UU church and Episcopal parish similarly described to me. It was sort of amazing to hear both people at both churches talking in the same way. Some people talked about life's sacred diversity as a living universe with a capital U. Others used the terms collective unconscious, great spirit, higher power, nature, energy, or even some unconventional and mystical conception of God that exists within all of us. Regardless of the names they use, those churches constantly encourage participants to embrace the variety of sacred experiences in their lives and in the lives of those around them, and to glimpse in that mosaic a bigger picture of something more in life that reveals, reflects, and celebrates the inclusive values we cherish. The two thriving churches I studied were spiritual and growing communities of faith, and as such, they were and remain unique successes among inclusive churches in America. So in conclusion, let me emphasize the good news revealed by my research. It is that inclusive congregations are not inevitably weak institutions or doomed to failure in the decades ahead. They can succeed, and some are, by offering liberal-minded people a range of social and social activist opportunities combined with unifying spiritual routines that ground their lives and help them transcend their differences. They not only tolerate diversity intellectually, but are finding creative and contemplative ways to worship diversity itself. Such interconnectedness is an ontological experience that public opinion surveys have shown is what millions of so-called spiritual but not religious seekers in the U.S. are looking for among today's religious options, a spiritual basis for their liberal values, for loving your neighbor as yourself, for feeling connected to others, even when they use different words, hold different beliefs, and engage in different practices, that within the complex, ever-shifting universe, there is something sacred and mysterious that inclusive people can worship together. And that gets them up on Sunday mornings, week after week, year after year. My hope is that my study will eventually help a variety of other churches learn how to model the Albuquerque congregation's success. Not by becoming exactly like that church, but instead by discovering their own progressive ways for evoking meaningful experiences of unifying worship around the inclusive ideals we all share as religious liberals. Thank you for allowing me to speak today. May it be.
Thank you very much for a thought-provoking sermon there. It's time now for our sharing of financial responsibilities. Our offering is an extension of our gratitude for our community of thoughtfulness, tolerance, and the ability to gather, sharing joys, sorrows, memory, and hope. Speaker has agreed to answer a few questions. We could have three questions. I would request that the questions be short and concise and if I may say, actually questions rather than miniature sermonettes or not so miniature sermonettes.
In this time when our the political structures of this country are such a subject for skepticism, the thing that we are in a unique position to contribute to this country is our connection to the really only unique spiritual tradition this country has, the tradition of transcendentalism, which I think would make this denomination a natural place for people who are looking for a spiritual path commensurate with our history to locate themselves. I just want to get feedback on that.
It's interesting that the minister in Albuquerque said that the only sort of religious term that she was comfortable identifying with was transcendentalist. So she found a lot of meaning in that her own experience through that term.
Something I had noticed from the whole time I've been with this church is that most of the people within it appear to be travelers, in that they've started somewhere else literally and moved across the country eventually into here, as well as traveling across religions and different ideas over life. And I wondered if you'd noticed a similar thing, that most Unitarians appear to be traveling. I noticed just recently when we did our movie thing, someone asked the question of who all, where are you born and so forth. And I discovered of the 22 people there, I was the only one that was born in Fullerton. We're all from Fullerton for the church. But I noticed growing up, I attended other religions, and everyone was always in the same. They'd always lived there their whole lives and so forth, but listen, it's not that way. Just wondering if you had noticed a similarity.
Oh, absolutely. And it's something like 90% of our denomination was raised in a different faith tradition. So they come into the denomination. And what's interesting then is, why aren't we growing faster? It's because we do have an attrition rate that unfortunately is almost equal to the number of new people joining us. So we have to find a way to keep people over time. And what I found is that at both the UU Church in Albuquerque and the Episcopal Parish, it was the fact that not only did they have these grounded traditions that they could count on week after week, but they also had a lot of new resources. The ministers in both of those churches were extremely innovative, were always developing new sorts of spiritual programs. The Episcopal minister was doing like a Hindu chant service on one of the nights during the week. He had a contemplative program. And so that attracted a lot of people. And I think for the seekers, it gave them a reason to stay over time because it kept changing. It was kept developing. It kept teaching them, giving them new information. At the Unitarian Church, Christine, the minister, would go through talking about the different religious traditions every single year. There would be a component of the year where she would touch on Christianity and invite all the people, thank them for being there, since half the denomination was atheist or agnostic humanists, and they found a way to connect with even that message of hearing from different religious traditions. And I think it was the fact that it was always new, always changing, always helping these travelers, feeding these travelers, that kept them to stay with the group and allow the group to grow.
I'm curious, I don't know if the study was able to break down whether, when you say people come for different reasons, do men come for the same reasons as women? Do younger people come for the same reasons as the older? I wonder if that varies quite a bit.
In all religious traditions, almost, women have always been sort of the backbone of most religious groups. And it's true at the Unitarian Church and at the Episcopal Parish. The Episcopal Parish, I think, had more men involved. It was probably 60-40. UU Church, it was probably 70-30. But I think the women were the ones who sort of grounded and said, this is feeding my spiritual experience. This is where I need to be each week. And husband, you're coming with me. Our kids were going, but a lot of the men were open to sort of engaging in spiritual practices as well. They had yoga groups, they had a lot of different programs during the week, and so a lot of men were who, especially those who were usually introverts or who were, you know, sensitive to spiritual experience, they definitely latched on and wanted to be committed to the group as well, equal to their wives.
And you talk about attrition, and I was wondering, we've raised our kids in a union church, and I'm wondering if you have any statistics regarding what will happen as they go into adulthood. I know I've heard some, and they weren't encouraging.
Yeah, I don't have the data right now. I do know it's really extremely painful, and it's all the mainline traditions that lose kids. You know, kids come in, they're raised usually through elementary school. At junior high, they start agitating. High school, they're very reluctant participants, and by, you know, young adulthood, they're out the door. And a lot of them don't come back until they have a reason to come back, usually after they're married and they have kids of their own and they want to raise them just like they were raised. But again, as soon as their kids grow up, they leave oftentimes, unless, you know, they have particular friendships. And that's not just at the U Church, it's also at, you know, most of the mainline congregations. I was amazed how few people would talk about religious topics like at the United Church of Christ. They identify as Christian nominally, but they're not engaged in religious discussions whatsoever. And so there was really no spiritual component. There's nothing bigger than those individual interactions for people to kind of latch on to over time. And they had huge feuds and they had schisms, and it was really a tough thing to watch in the United Church of Christ, because they had nothing bigger than those individual relationships to hold on to.
Please join me in another round of applause for our speaker.